This is Matt Leiner, and you're listening to Reign of Troy Radio.
Reign of Troy Hotline.
How's it going, guys? Return caller.
Just want to say, love everything about the UFC game tonight. You guys get me. My wife doesn't get me.
Alicia, Michael, what's going on?
It's not just hyperbole that the best team in the Pac-12 is going to the Rose Bowl.
I played Madden, and I know I can call a better game.
Just punted down three possessions in the fourth quarter.
Show me stuff. Why can't we just win a game?
Can I blame Bob Connolly for this?
Is there no standards? Like, could I put on a zebra shirt and just go out there?
You look at the beginning of the season, you're like, they were so good.
I actually think this is a case of optimistic, Alicia.
It's caught by Jarrett, the 40, 35, 30. Johnson needs some blocking help. Gets one block at the 25, 20. He's going to go. That's Koga bleed.
The people around me, myself, soon as he made that first move, we all jumped out of our seats. Everyone knew he was gone.
We out-passioned them today.
What a burger for everybody.
All right, let's start this because I am going to fall over.
All right, Trojan fans, turn up the volume. It's time for Reign of Troy Radio. Here's your host, Michael Castillo.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Reign of Troy Radio, episode 180. We are recording on Wednesday, December 28th. We're a couple of days away from USC and Penn State meeting for the 103rd edition of the Rose Bowl game in Pasadena on January 2nd, Monday, 2 p.m. on ESPN. We are going to preview the big game, give you our predictions, and much more here on this episode. As always, follow us on Twitter at Reign of Troy, like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Reign of Troy. Be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Overcast, Google Play, and Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/Reign of Troy. Our email address is reignoftroy@fanside.com, and our phone number is 213-373-1872. I'm your host, Michael Castillo, joining along with my co-host, the editor of Reign of Troy, Alicia D'Artola.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Alicia. I mean, we've been prepping for this episode for a long time, and finally it's here. Everyone's going to know what weird, stupid score you're going to pick to be your prediction for the Rose Bowl.
I guarantee it will be weird, and it will be stupid.
That goes without saying. That's what you tend to do, weird numbers, all that kind of crap. When you go into it, what goes into picking a number?
I like odd, even number combinations. So, like, you can't, you have to, like, get a weird number is like a 7. A 7 is a weird number to me for some reason. Like, a 2 is not a weird number. A 4 is a normal number. But a 7, like, 27 is always a good score. Or just going by weird football numbers, like, how often do you see a scoreline where there's 26 points or 29 points? Like, you can't go with the 14, 17, 21, 24. Those kinds of conventions. That's my weird number thoughts.
So basically you're gonna say that the final score is gonna be 13-9.
13-9, except for the 9, if it was 13-8, like 13-8 is the stupidest football score you could possibly have.
No, it's 11-8.
You're right. 11-8 is a stupid football score. And I love it. Well, only better would be 11-1, and that's not happening.
Hey, it could happen if there's a 1-point safety.
You know what? Actually, I take it back. 11-4 is my new, like, someone needs to find out if a game has ever finished in the history of football.
There's been 6-4 games.
I want 11-4.
11-4.
11-4.
Okay, so you want a touchdown with a 2-point conversion, and a field goal, and a couple of safeties.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or it could be like a safety and then a returned. No, because you'd need the 2-point conversion. Yeah, well, I don't know
if it was
how you
a 1-point safety, but I think to score a 1-point safety, I think, I don't remember. There's a way to score a 1-point safety. I don't remember how it is.
3 field goals and a safety on one end, and then 2 safeties on the other.
I'm sorry, but this sounds like the most agonizing game of all time.
Yeah, yeah, I'd watch it, though.
Agonizing. No, I'm not down for that, but hopefully Saturday, I mean, Monday, it's Monday. Drill that into your head. Monday afternoon is super exciting, January 2nd, for the Rose Bowl. We need people to get interactive. This is an interactive show. You send us your tweets, we will read it on the podcast. You send us your emails, we will read them. But most importantly, you gotta give us your calls on the Reign of Troy rant line, rave line, whatever the hell it's going to be. 213-373-1872 is the phone number. Again, that's 213 373-1-USC. Suck it, What's Bruin Show. Got it. Nailed it. Nailed it.
See, the level of difficulty matters.
I know, and it's much easier when you're recording a podcast on the kitchen table. A lot easier. A lot easier.
Yeah, we play when we try to do that on Skype, it's like playing Alabama. When they do it in person, it's like playing Chattanooga State. So
or Tennessee Chattanooga.
Tennessee Northern Tennessee Chattanooga State University.
But Alicia, let's get into the news. We don't have our soundboard, so let's pretend that there's news, a news little chime going on. Biggest news coming out on Wednesday, Penn State has suspended two players, linebacker Manny Bowen and wide receiver Saeed Blacknell. They are suspended for violation of team rules. How big of a deal is this for Penn State and for USC going against those guys?
I think it's really interesting that Penn State suspends players today, having found out yesterday that USC is suspending a couple players too. It's just that these are like a completely different situation. USC can survive and do fine. You probably won't even notice that Buda Tucker and Kevin Scott are suspended. But the guys that Penn State suspended, they're both starters. They're both contributors on this team. They're going to require lineup shuffling and all of that. So I think it is actually a pretty big deal. They're not like the key players. They're not a Saquon Barkley. They're not a Trace McSorley or a Marcus Allen or any one of those guys. But they are the contributing guys. I mean, Blacknell getting suspended is almost like Daniel Amatabebe getting suspended, a guy who maybe wasn't contributing a lot early in the season but had become a key figure late. I mean, he was huge for Penn State in the Big Ten title game. And then Bowen is, you know, started 12 games at linebacker, and they do have a reliable replacement for him in Koa Farmer, but you're still talking about one less player there to help you with your depth, one less player with experience that's there to pick up the slack for you depending on what goes on in the game. So not an ideal situation at all for Penn State. I think USC should be very, very happy that they're not the ones that are suspending starters. I mean, for now, cross your fingers and hope that we're not jinxing it.
Yeah, I mean,
we might be jinxing it.
A lot can change. There is still a few days. Things do happen. Knock on wood. It doesn't happen for SC. But you look at Saeed Blacknell, 27 targets, 15 catches, 347 yards, 3 touchdowns, average yards per catch 23.1. He's the big play guy. I mean, you and I were watching the Ohio State game. In that game, he had one catch, and it was just a bomb downfield. And so that's one of the things where he can really stretch the field vertically for Penn State, and that's a big loss.
And that started a run of games where, I mean, he's not a prolific guy, but I think there was a run of 4 games starting with Ohio State, and the minute he became the starter against Purdue, where he had just one catch per game, but those were 40-yard, 30-yard catches, 19-yard touchdown catch against Iowa, leading into the title game where he really exploded onto the scene. And I think if you were a Penn State fan, you were looking at it thinking, man, he could really be a weapon to use against USC. And we're going to talk even more about Penn State's offense and what they are and what they do. And when you think about taking one more guy who can hit a home run off of that field, that is huge for USC's defense. So, you know, we won't know what he will have done against USC, but we definitely know he's not going to be catching a long touchdown pass. So, you know.
Moving on, some other news to discuss. USC's offensive players and offensive coordinator T. Martin met with the media at StubHub Center in Carson, home of the Galaxy. We were there. Anything that came from that press conference of sorts that stands out for you?
I just think T. Martin is a really interesting person to talk to, and I think he talking to him about the progression of the offense, especially the dynamic of he talked about the difficulties of shuffling quarterbacks in and out in the first month of the season and sort of getting a hold on what the identity of that offense was going to be and how much Sam Darnold clarified things for USC and the way that they just progressed through the year and sort of how they're going to tackle Penn State and really deal with the pass rush that Penn State brings to the table. I always just find him really interesting. It was nice talking to Justin Davis, especially because he is getting back to full health. And I think T. Martin said that that he was probably at 85% at the end of the season when he was getting back from that ankle sprain. Davis himself talked about how he was just out there trying to get by. He wasn't really himself as a running back, and he feels like he's ready to go, and he feels like he's back. And T. Martin said he looks like he's back the way he's able to cut in practice now. So I think coming out of this week, the news out of USC is all really positive, in the sense that the injuries, guys have really gotten time to rest their bodies. And Justin Davis talked about that specifically, about how with a running back, you know, you take punishment every time you play. So every day that you're not taking punishment helps you a lot. And 3 weeks of not taking punishment has really allowed his body to get back into tip-top shape. And that's going to be true across the board with the receivers, with a guy like Juju Smith-Schuster, with a guy like Sed Ware, and all of those guys who have been dealing with the naggy kind of injuries. And underrated, the guy that I always forget, like Deontay Burnett, played with a sprained knee for the last month of the season. So there's another guy who's going to be much closer to 100%.
So did Chinonuusu. On defense, he had a little bit of a knee deal as well. My only question with the whole, like, you know, the offense being back and in terms of the running game, everyone being healthy, everyone being at a better form, does it kind of worry you that early on in the season, the running game wasn't there? You would have Justin Davis look really good, and Ronald Jones and Sed Ware would just be kind of, okay. They weren't anything to write home about. Does it worry you that the three-headed monster maybe is too many cooks in the kitchen compared to when it was stripped down and when it was just Ronald Jones and then Sed Ware or Justin Davis or Dominic Davis and not all of them together? SC was so much better when that was happening. Is that just Ronald Jones being that much better than everyone else? Or is it a, you know, factor of how they distribute the carries?
I think distributing the carries between three backs is always going to be a problem. But I think the thing that you also have to look at from the first month of the season, USC's offensive line wasn't doing that well. Like, watching those games, I remember thinking to myself, I don't think this is a running back problem. When I looked at what Ronald Jones was doing, I didn't think that he was doing anything in particular. I just saw a lot of inconsistency on the up front for USC, and I think they've gotten much better at that. They still are prone, as all offensive lines are, prone to those just boneheaded, just let everyone through and then you're screwed kind of moments. But I think they've gelled a little bit more, and they've come together a little bit more, and that might make the whole too many cooks in the kitchen thing a little bit less of a concern if your offensive line is really gelling and coming together. What doesn't really matter which running back that you have out there. And I think that was another interesting thing that T. Martin talked about, is the idea that he doesn't call plays for any one running back. He calls the same plays. What changes is the outcome of those plays depending on which running back is out there, not necessarily in a good or bad way, but in a, well, you know, Dominic Davis could break this 80 yards. Ronald Jones could, you know, shimmy one way and then get into space. Justin Davis could sneak through a hole and go this way or that. And they all have their strengths, and they don't really, I think to a guy like T. Martin, they're all interchangeable, even though that's not a reflection of how important one is over the other. It's just that they're all reliable in that sense.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to Zach Banner, and I asked him what I thought was kind of a stupid question in hindsight to ask.
There are no stupid questions.
trust me, there are. I asked him, you know, when you're blocking for two guys that are completely different, like Justin Davis and Ronald Jones, and they're more similar than, say, Lendale and Reggie, but they're still different backs. Do you block differently depending on who the guy is behind you? And he's like, he laughed and said, no, you block the same because they have to change to us. And I think that goes exactly what you're saying, that if you run everything exactly the same and whoever is in the backfield is in the backfield, and that's a separate thing, and that's something that maybe Tommy Robinson runs more than T. Martin runs, it makes sense. I mean, it makes sense, and it's all like muscle memory at that point, because then you're trying to just just gel on as a play caller, as a blocker, the blocking schemes and everything. And maybe that is a big part of it. Like you said, I mean, the offensive line was not good at the beginning of the season. They've gotten better. I still don't think they're the best offensive line in the country or anything like that, but they have gotten better for sure.
Yeah, and I think that's why we talk about the sort of advanced statistical measures like opportunity rate, where the first 5 yards of any run are basically attributed to the offensive line. The running back just has to not screw up. The running back has to, you know, the running back can pick the wrong hole to hit, and then that's on them. But I don't know that that is a problem that USC has with any of these running backs. I think they're all very, very intelligent and instinctive and are generally good at doing that. Where you go from there, from 5 yards out, well, 5 yards is a successful run. So then we're talking about USC having running backs like Davis and Rojo and Ware, who what they do matters from the 5 yard mark and on. And I think all of them have shown, and particularly Rojo, Davis. I mean, you look back at the highlight packages from USC's early in the season, and I cannot tell you the number of times that Justin Davis had just smart, really savvy highlight runs that maybe didn't result in a touchdown, that you just look at it and go, damn, that's a good running back. That's a really good running back. Just the little shifts and cuts that he's able to do.
In the 3 games before he got hurt, I mean, including the Colorado game, so Utah, ASU, and Colorado combined, he averaged 9.22 yards per carry.
Yeah.
And this is why I don't understand the people that are like, it's all about Ronald Jones and Justin Davis is, he's not that good and all that. Like, you obviously weren't watching the games. You weren't watching the games because Ronald Jones arguably was better than Ronald Jones. I mean, sorry. Justin Davis at his peak this year was arguably better than Ronald Jones was at his peak. And that's a great problem to have. And not that it's a problem, but it's a great, you know, position to be in for SC to have those two great backs compared to Penn State, which is all boom or bust with one guy. Saquon Barkley, I mean, you look at the backfield, they got other guys in there that can definitely help out. But 99% of their running game is all through Saquon Barkley, if it's not Trace McSorley.
Yeah, and if Saquon Barkley is shut down, if he's not on it on the day or anything happens to him, they don't have too many options. Whereas, I mean, technically, Justin Davis was the starting running back to start this season. He goes down. Ronald Jones was the backup. He's now the number one. So if you lose Ronald Jones or he's off it on the day, you go down one step and you're not going down. You're just sort of staying at a starting level player. And then you take even another step back and you're looking at a said where. And I don't think anyone who has watched USC practice or play at any point this season would sit back and say that said where is anything but a starting option for USC. If USC got down to have to start said where, I would still feel very confident.
Yeah, and then right behind him, you have future Heisman Trophy winner Dominic Davis. So, yeah. Hey.
Well, and even then, I mean, a guy who no one, you know, fans haven't gotten to see this year, but I am so excited to see next year is Vai Malapai, or however you say his name. We need to really figure that one out.
Vai Malapai.
Well, we can call him Vai, though. That's his nickname.
That's what they're calling him.
That's
Vai?
What Helton calls him, so okay. I'm going with it. So we'll all go right. Vai, but I still can't do the last name. But either way, that dude who's redshirting, who you won't see in the Rose Bowl, but like, let's say there was some catastrophic situation and all of USC's running backs got injured and they had to burn his redshirt, I wouldn't be that worried.
First of all, that would never happen. You would go with the Dory in the backfield every down before you would burn his redshirt.
Put the ball in CB2 Kolobatu's hands.
Exactly. That's what you do there. But Alicia, let's get into talking about this game. It's the Rose Bowl. It's something that we grew up watching. It's something that I grew up going to. It's something that, you know, I went to the parade every year until I was like 14 and realized that this is really freaking boring and I don't want to go to this anymore.
No, going to the parade is fun, but the key is to stay at home, wake up and have like drink hot chocolate in your PJs and watch the parade. That's what I've done every year of my life.
That works.
Well, that I didn't go
it,
to the parade.
It works. I feel like being at the parade's better than watching it on TV, but watching
being warm at home with hot chocolate is very
you don't hear important. The bands, you don't really get to see the people straight up like
yeah, no, it's an experience to definitely be there, but I value greatly that experience. I'm bummed because my cousin's getting married on New Year's Eve, so my parents are gonna be up in Idaho for the weekend, and so I, you know, this tradition that I have with my family of watching the Rose Parade is not going to be possible this year. It kind of bums me out. But the Rose Bowl will make up for it.
Who gets married on New Year's Eve?
That's what I said. I love this cousin of mine, but I can't. I told her I couldn't go to the wedding because I couldn't guarantee that I wouldn't be tied up. I wasn't even thinking Rose Bowl. I just thought I would be tied up with other, you know, work because of bowl games in general. But
yeah, I mean, I think that might be worse
in
than
Idaho.
Yeah,
in Idaho, she's getting married on New Year's Eve.
You know what that
in
is?
Idaho.
You know what that is? That is a hey, we're getting married. You totally don't have to come. That's, we understand.
That's worse than like the Sun Bowl. Like, who wants to be in El Paso on New Year's Eve? Well, who wants to be in
that's true.
Idaho on New Year's
that's
Eve?
That's true. But
no offense to Idaho, sorry. It's a beautiful state.
Hey, and French fries are wonderful, and potatoes as well. But let's talk about Penn State. Penn State's offense, 38th in S&P Plus, 36.7 points per game, which ranks 25th nationally. A little bit slow, 66.9 plays per game, which is 102nd in adjusted pace. But this is a spread offense. It's an offense that looks very similar to what USC runs, where it's a I don't want to call it a power spread because it doesn't feel like a power spread like you would talk about like a Tom Herman Ohio State power spread, but they are not they are more power-ish than delicate, if you want to put it that way. Very similar to what SC runs. Trace McSorley is a guy you have equated him to your brother playing NCAA or playing Madden.
Yes, he's a mobile quarterback. My brother used to piss me off by playing I think it was Ohio State with Troy Smith,
yeah,
or one of their mobile.
Terrell Pryor was really good in that game too.
Yeah, I don't remember which of them was. I just know that it was Ohio State, and he used to do this thing where he would just run like read options or whatever, where he'd either run the ball or run out into the flat and then see if he's going to try and run or just toss up a long throw. And I literally watching Penn State's offense is what, like, my brother could be their offensive coordinator. They are unsuccessful play, get to third down, except not third down because they're bad at third downs. But the point being is that they have, you know, two or three unsuccessful plays and then throw up a long bomb, get a chunk of yards, and start over. And that's what they do. Like, they'll run the ball for a couple yards, hit you for 40. And Trace McSorley is exactly that kind of quarterback where he'll run a keeper, he'll go back to pass, you'll rush him and get pressure, but he'll just squirm away and then toss up a bomb to someone downfield for the first down or a big gainer. And I think your comparison on him is also really apt. The poor man's Johnny Manziel.
Yeah, the poor man's Johnny Manziel in the sense that he's someone who will run if he needs to, and there's a lot of design runs, and he's short in stature, and he doesn't have the strongest arm, but that doesn't take away from his ability to make a play, and doesn't take away from his ability to throw the ball downfield and make his receivers go up and get it. And, you know, you watch that Ohio State game. The touchdown to Chris Godwin at the end of the first half was totally one of those plays. The big long touchdown, I mean, pass to set up a touchdown in the fourth quarter, whatever it was, to Saeed Blacknall. Same thing. Just throw it up, make your dude make a play. And Penn State is really good at that, and they're really good at taking shots downfield. Chris Godwin talked about it on Tuesday at Disneyland, that one thing he really likes with Joe Moorhead as the offensive coordinator, and the big change is that he knows when to call his shots, and he takes the shots downfield, and that's really exciting as a player to have an offense like that, which I'm sure it is, because like you said, it's like playing a video game, and that's super fun. But comparing this to USC's defense and how SC can go up against this pass game, because you look at Trace McSorley's numbers, and you know you mentioned it a little bit, that they're not necessarily efficient. Trace McSorley's only completing 57.5% of his passes. Penn State is second in passing S&P Plus, but they're only 51st in success rate. So it's a lot of chunk plays or nothing at all. What does SC need to do to shut those down? Because the chunk plays are obviously a big deal.
I think the big word for USC's defense is discipline. Helton has talked about it. Clancy Pendergast has talked about it. With a quarterback like Trace McSorley, you have to keep contain and not lose him on the edge. You have to be really disciplined and not let him get loose and burn you with his feet. But at the same time, he does that thing that Sam Darnold has really hurt opposing defenses, where when he scrambles, it's not always just to take off and run. He's got his eyes downfield and he's looking to find receivers who know that they have an improvisational quarterback and will come back to the ball and give him an option. So from front to back, from the defensive line, who, you know, when you look at, for instance, the Ohio State game, McSorley was able to run away and get loose. It really depends on not the guys who provide the initial pressure, but everyone else on the line working as a unit to not let him escape. You move back to the linebackers to keep to keep on top of things and know when he is moving and when they need to go in and clean up as well. And then into the secondary, you can't let go of your man just because McSorley is scrambling or just because he's taken off, because he will burn you if you let him loose. So discipline from start to finish, from front to back, will be the key. I mean, when I look at it, that's what I'm sure that the defensive coaches are preaching right now. Just stay on top of things. And the thing I've heard repeated a lot from USC's players, I'm guessing it's coming from a coach: mind your P's and Q's. Mind your P's and Q's. Just, you know, be detailed and disciplined.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it. We've seen a ton of touchdowns scored against SC where there's been just miscommunications and assignments. A couple of those against Alabama. The touchdown pass that was thrown to Christian McCaffrey in week 3 at Stanford. We've seen that kind of stuff all the time. So that's the stuff that, if SC can take out those, that it's a good thing. Force Penn State to make those plays. Don't give them those plays. Is definitely the mindset you want to have.
I mean, and it's a different opponent for sure. It's definitely a different quarterback. But I keep thinking about the Washington game and how, you know, Washington was dangerous in their explosive plays as well, and USC gave up an explosive play or two, but that was it. They limited it. So this defense, you know, you can survive getting hit once or twice, getting punched in the mouth, but you just can't have the glass jaw and go down. You just got to get yourself back up and know that this is, like you said, this is not an efficient offense. So if you give up the one play, fine, but you will have opportunities to shut them down in other areas and slow them down that way. They're not going to be successful every time. And it's kind of like picking your battles. Like, Penn State's going to pick their battles, taking shots downfield. USC needs to just make sure that they're consistent, because if they are, then the one or two plays that they give up won't be the problem. If they stay with it the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth time down the line.
One of the playmakers I wanted to bring up and talk about a little bit is Mike Gesicki, who is, I believe he's a patented drool-worthy player. As far as you're concerned.
Hey, you just came up with a new Roddy Award.
The drool-worthy.
The drool-worthy, yeah. Player of the year.
Which will always go to a tight end. Yeah,
well, sure. I mean, this year, no, spoiler alert, guys, it's going to a tight end. But
but you look at Mike Gesicki for Penn State, 47 catches, 668 yards, four touchdowns, a 70.1 catch rate on his targets, which is pretty solid. It's just practically the best on Penn State's receiving core, if you include the tight ends. You know, you watched him a little bit. When he's going downfield and he's wide open, how much does that make you cringe? And then how much does it make you think, oh my God, I want to see that.
Mommy,
it,
I want one. yeah, you know, I kind of want to continue the Trace McSorley, Johnny Manziel comparison. I feel like Mike Gesicki might be McSorley's Mike Evans. That receiving target. I mean, he's a tight end. He's not a receiver, but that receiving target who you just throw it up and he'll just go up and get it. He's that kind of tight end. The mismatch is never good for the defense when he's involved. And he's sort of the prototype. I mean, we call them drool-worthy, but the reason I love tight ends so much is because a guy like Mike Gesicki creates that kind of matchup problem. And the way that you see him just be too big and too fast and too strong for defenses, that is exactly why tight end can be such a really dangerous position to have an exceptional player in. So yeah, when I see him, that's a worry for me, because I'm not sure where USC, you know, how do you stop a guy like Mike Gesicki? I'm not certain.
I think the biggest thing that plays into his favor too is that there's so many receivers, so many guys you have to keep an eye out for. Chris Godwin, Deshaun Hamilton, DeAndre Hopkins, Saeed Blacknell before he was suspended. So many guys you got to keep an eye on. Saquon Barkley is averaging 15.1 yards per catch, which is insane for a running back. Like, you've never seen that number in your life, right? For someone who has 23 catches for 347 yards, that's an insane average. So there's so many guys you have to watch in the passing game that are doing so many similar things that it's pretty easy to leave the tight end open wide open down the seam. And so that's a big worry for SC.
Yeah, and it's something that I'm sure Pendergast and company are game planning for and trying to figure out. I'm trying to think if USC has been really, really harmed by a tight end this season.
I'm coming up with blanks. Usually you can think of those moments. 2012 was the year that they were just devastated by tight ends. I mean, you saw Joe Fourier from UCLA with just back-breaking catch after back-breaking catch. Chris Coyle from ASU had a bunch of big catches that year. A bunch of dudes in 2012 were able to do that. Tyler Eifert for Notre Dame. But
Stanford tight ends have always been...
Yeah, Zach Ertz, Levine Toilolo. Like, those guys have always killed SC. So you expect it if you were a USC fan. You expect the tight end to get open. Though it has been kind of a good year for defending tight ends for SC. O.J. Howard didn't really do much for Alabama in week one. Mind you, that was a long time ago.
Who was the all Pac-12 tight end?
First team was Farrell Brown. Second team was Nate Iasi from UCLA.
Yeah, and Iasi didn't really do too much damage against USC. So
I mean, nobody from UCLA did damage other than Jordan Lasley. That was it.
That's true. So are we, I mean, you know, causation and correlation and all this kind of stuff. Was it just not a big year for tight ends on USC's schedule? Or was USC doing something in particular to make them not?
I don't know. I don't know. It's not like SC had Sua Craven this year, who was just really good at, you know, covering from an outside linebacker position, someone who was really good in coverage. SC didn't really have that guy, so I can't really say that it was because of that. Moving on to the run game, where SC has been really, really good. In November, they were really good. You know, held Washington just 17 yards, held Oregon to 85. UCLA didn't do much either. Going up against a team like Penn State, who has Saquon Barkley, 1,302 yards on the season, 16 touchdowns, 5.3 yards per carry, an opportunity rate of 34.8. So he's a guy who gets a lot of carries, and he's a mass quantity guy, but he also can slither, and he can pick up some big runs as well, and he can catch balls out of the backfield like we just had mentioned. What worries you about that, and do you think that this is something SC can be successful with, trying to shut down that Penn State running game? Because when you look at the numbers, that, you know, they're 100th in the country in success in rushing success rate, they're 121st in the country in stuff rate. 24% of their rushes get zero or negative yards, which is not a good number.
No,
not a good number at all. What goes into that matchup for you?
Yeah, I think that number is the key. I think the running game for Penn State sort of reflects the overall offense, the idea of feast or famine. And say it start, you know, Saquon Barkley is a guy who can break a home run and really hurt you. And I believe Clay Helton called him the most complete back that USC will have faced this season. And him being a complete back means that he's going to be able to find. He can hurt you in a lot of different ways, and that can be dangerous as well. But We talked earlier about offensive lines and all that kind of stuff. That stuff rate is a reflection of an offensive line that's screwing up 25% of the time, or 24% if you want to be like exact. So, you know, Saquon Barkley is a guy who, if given an opportunity, will hurt you. But if the offensive line doesn't give him the opportunity, then he's just going to be stuck. And that's going to be what USC needs to really, really focus on is, you know, reproduce the defensive line performance that you had against Washington, and you'll be good to go. Like you'll be able to deal with a guy like Saquon Barkley. And I know that USC has pinpointed shutting him down as one of the keys to their defensive performance, because Penn State relies so heavily on him to be the workhorse in their offense. And if you're able to limit his success, then you're going to limit Penn State's success as a whole. And then it does become that game of, well, do you stop Penn State from taking that shot downfield? Then the game just becomes the coin flip of, did you prevent that long touchdown pass?
You know, you mentioned the Penn State offensive line. You look at the roster, three freshmen, two redshirt freshmen and a true freshman. A true freshman is the right guard, Connor McGovern, 6'5", 310, true freshman there. And the two redshirt freshmen are the left tackle, Ryan Bates, and the left guard, Steven Gonzalez. So not a lot of experience up front, and there's been a lot of change in how they've started as well. I mean, you haven't just had, outside of Gia at center, no one has really started every single game on that offensive line. So that just tells you how much turnover they've had. At left tackle, they've had three different guys make starts. At left guard, they've had, you look at it, like four different guys make starts. At right guard, they've had two guys. At right tackle, they've had three guys. And mind you, some of those guys have started at multiple positions, but there's just not much continuity on that line, which definitely goes into things like stuff rate, like you mentioned. And really, I mean, 34.8 opportunity rate is not good for Saquon Barkley. I mean, when we were complaining about Ronald Jones earlier in the season, it was because he was below 35%. You want to be over 40%, and you don't want to be that low. And I think it really tells you how good Saquon Barkley is that he can put up as many yards as he has, and he can be as good of a player as he is despite that. And really, it gives credence to Trace McSorley for everything he can do despite the offensive line not necessarily being there. And for him to be able to have 340 whatever yards he has as a quarterback and stay upright and be able to run and scramble and have it to his benefit and not just be running for his life, I think that really helps. Because a lot like Sam Darnold, where Sam Darnold kind of masked the problems of USC's offensive line, Trace McSorley and Saquon Barkley have done that exactly to a T for Penn State.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why when you look at Penn State, they really feel like you sort of see so many parallels with USC over the years, particularly in the fact that they have these reliable skill players, but you're just not certain about the guys in the trenches. And that's why they're so feast or famine, because you have the horses to run. You just need more consistent support for them. And you look at what Penn State's offensive line has done compared to USC's. We always talk about the 11 sacks as being, we wonder how much of that is the offensive line and how much is that Sam Darnold. Well, Trace McSorley is at least as elusive as Sam Darnold, but he's been sacked 23 times this season, which is, not terrible, but not good at all. It's sort of in the 50s of national rank this season. So I think McSorley is running for his life more often than Sam Darnold is running for his life. And it's also part of the reason why just everything about Penn State's offense is all sort of interlinked, where these feast or famine plays happen in part because plays break down and because McSorley is able to do something with them. And when plays break down, the secondaries break down and all of that kind of stuff. But you see the reflection in a stuff rate. You see the reflection in how many sacks they've given up. And just their overall performance of the offensive line, they rank 121st in offensive line S&P Plus this season, which is just not good by any measure.
And you put that against a defensive line for USC that's really stepped up. I mean, that's been the hallmark of this team. You can talk about Sam Darnold, how Sam Darnold willed the offense, or you can talk about Ronald Jones, but it's the defensive line for me that has just been so clutch for this team the last eight games, and why they have an eight-game winning streak. They're all gelling at the right time, and I think that really has got to be worrisome if you're Penn State. We're going to take a quick break and then come back and talk about Penn State's defense going up against USC's offense led by Sam Darnold and company. So we'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Random Troy Radio. This is our preview episode for USC and Penn State meeting up in the 103rd edition of the Rose Bowl game on January 2nd. At the Rose Bowl, obviously. Let's talk about Penn State's defense going up against USC's offense. The Nittany Lions run a 4-3 defense. They're 16th in S&P Plus with a points per game average of 23.4 against, which is 33rd nationally. They're third nationally in tackles for loss, so they're a team that loves to get in the backfield, apply pressures, and a lot of havoc rate kind of stuff. 19th overall in team havoc rate at an 18.7%. So there's someone who can really, you know, make it hectic on a quarterback and make it hectic on your skill players. On Wednesday at StubHub Center, Sam Darnold said that they really get creative with their pressures. And Zach Banner talked about it as well, that even though they're a four-man front, which might be a little bit different than what you see a lot of times in the Pac-12, with so many teams going to a 3-4 to defend the spread in the Pac-12, they still get so creative in their pressures that they're not necessarily this slow-prodding 4-3 that kind of is outdated at times in college football.
Yeah, and that's the big thing that USC needs to look out for, and I believe T. Martin was sort of echoing those feelings that Penn State is able to bring pressure whether they're bringing a blitz or not. They get good production out of their defensive line, their front four. And you see that in the defensive line havoc rate. They're 20th in the country. You see that with their linebacker havoc rate. They're 20th in the country. So they're really getting a lot of production from the front seven. And they like to play in opposing backfields. And that includes getting after running backs in the backfield, and that includes getting after quarterbacks in the backfield. So T. Martin said, and I think Clay Helton has said, and everyone's sort of echoing this, job number one is to neutralize that pass rush, neutralize that front seven that is going to be aggressive and is going to try to disrupt what you do. And I mean, from a USC perspective, I think this is where Sam Darnold is really going to have to show his chops. Keep calm and do what he's been doing over the last 2 months, where the pass rush doesn't bother him. He keeps his head on his shoulders and keeps his eyes downfield and is able to just make plays and not get flustered. His ability to handle that in on such a big occasion is going to be huge. But like everything that we've said today gets back to the offensive line. This offensive line is going to have to keep their composure and prove that they have really gelled and that they can limit their mistakes and keep their cool as well, because they are going to be facing waves and waves and waves and waves and waves of pressure. But like I said, the good thing is that USC has faced defenses that do want to get after you and do want to make it really difficult for you. And, you know, with the exception of Alabama, and we always talk about September as just being an entirely different monster, teams really haven't troubled USC in that sense over the course of the last 2 months. So it will be interesting to see if Penn State can do something that those teams have not done.
Yeah, and you look at it, Garrett Sickles is the danger man. He's the guy to watch for. A defensive end who's going to be lined up against Chad Wheeler, and I think that's going to be to me, this is the number one matchup on that side of the ball, because you don't have a marquee matchup like maybe Dory Jackson against Chris Godwin, which I think was going to be super fun, Biggie Marshall against Chris Godwin and Deshaun Hamilton and all that kind of stuff, but Garrett Sickles going up against Chad Wheeler, mano a mano, two seniors, two guys who have been around the block, two guys who know what they're doing, two guys who have, you know, made all-star teams and all that kind of stuff. This is the kind of matchup you kind of live for. your franchise left tackle against your dynamo defensive end. And Garrett Sickles, 34 tackles, 12 and a half tackles for loss, 6 sacks. He's someone who can really get after the quarterback. You saw it in that Ohio State game for Penn State. He turned the game around. 3.5 tackles for loss, 2.5 sacks in that game after being suspended for the entire first half. So he can turn momentum around on a dime, if you're listening for that, Paolo. And I think that it's someone SC needs to watch for. And luckily for Chad Wheeler, he's not someone who gives up a lot of sacks. Zach Banner talked about it on Wednesday morning that, you know, it's kind of tough when from the outsider perspective because you look at, okay, a sack happened on the right side, it must be Zach Banner's. A sack happened on the left side, it must be Chad Wheeler. And obviously, it's more nuanced than that. But still, you look at it and you don't think of many sacks coming from the left side all season.
Yeah, and like you said, this matchup is something that you feel like good on good is what Hilton is always talking about when they talk about practice. And that is where you have your, you know, potentially your best offensive linemen and their best defensive linemen, and they're going to go at it, and whoever wins that battle is going to make a huge difference for the outcome of the game. But again, this is where, you know, USC can rely on Darnold to recognize that Wheeler has a tough job in this game and that he might need to keep an eye on his own blind side and just be aware that might be coming. It's one of those matchups where you can't really predict who is going to win that one. That matchup is exactly why you play this game, because we can look at the statistics and we can look at everything and say, well, oh, Darnold shouldn't be able to negate this pass rush or this pass rush is really good, so it's going to give Darnold trouble, blah, blah, blah. But you play the game because when you match up a guy like Sickles and Wheeler, flip a coin and let's find out who will win that matchup. And if you talk to Chad Wheeler, he'll say that he'll win it. If you talk to Garrett Sickles, he'll say that he'll win it. And we won't know until January 2nd and when we look back on the game and say, well, this went one way or the other.
Yeah, definitely. Moving on, another thing to watch for about this defense, and really it goes with the Penn State offense. We didn't bring it up then when we were talking about them, but just the overall progression from first quarter to fourth quarter and how much they improve. You look at S&P Plus by quarter, defensively, first quarter, Penn State's defense is 54th, then 35th, 25th, and then second in the fourth quarter. Always getting better. The Penn State offense is 49th and 42nd in the first half, and then second and second in the second half. So the offense is maybe more of a contrast, whereas the defense is continuously getting better. For USC, how worrisome is that? I asked Clay Helton about it on Tuesday, that SC hasn't played a lot of 60-minute games. You know, really since, okay, the Washington game, you could say, was a 60-minute game. The Utah game was a 60-minute game. That's really it. I mean, you can, okay, Stanford, SC was trying to...
Colorado was...
Yeah, okay. You're right.
Three-quarter game, sort of. I mean, the fourth quarter mattered.
The fourth quarter mattered, and yeah. so did Notre Dame for most of it. So, okay.
But has USC had to come? USC, I guess what I would say is that USC has been able, when they've played the more complete games where they've been in doubt going into the fourth quarter, USC's mostly been protecting leads by that point. So that they definitely haven't really played too many meaningful fourth quarters, but when they have, they haven't had to come back in a fourth quarter. I actually can't remember the last time that USC did come back in a fourth quarter.
No, they haven't had to come back in a fourth quarter since the Stanford game was really the last time and really the only time all year that they had a chance to try to do that at least. But when you look at it offensively, what adjustments do you think SC could have to be ready and prepared to make, maybe? Do you think that this is a game where you need to use Adoree Jackson a lot on offense? Do you think it's a game where you need to be versatile in your play calling? Or if you're T. Martin, are you just going to try to stick to what works normally? Because the way Penn State gets so good and the way they make adjustments and the way they have success like that, I think you got to be prepared for a million different alternative outcomes going forward, especially into the second half.
Yeah, for USC offensively, I mean, I recently, we're doing a series of look backs on the past bowl games that happened, and on the 27th it was the anniversary of the 2014 Holiday Bowl. And you look at the 2014 Holiday Bowl, and that was such a weird game. What stuck with me looking back on it was that USC's offense was pitiful in the fourth quarter. And you look back on the 2015 Holiday Bowl, and USC's offense was pitiful in the fourth quarter. And I think one of the big disappointments about USC over the last few years is how they would go into a shell, and it would be counterproductive. The playing not to lose thing would bite them in the behind. So yeah, I think if USC has a lead that they are protecting late in that game, late in this game against Penn State, the last thing you want to do is go into a shell. I think your best defense is to score, is to take the pressure off of your defense by continuing to do what you've been doing and sort of staying on your game plan and staying with what you have prepared to do and all of that. So just being brave and not going into a shell would be really important in that context. Which I'm sure if you talked to T. Martin or you talked to Clay Helton or whatever, that's what they would say, that they wouldn't want to go into a shell. But it's one thing to say that, and it's an entirely, I mean, because you talk to Sark and that's exactly what he would say. But he fell into that trap way too many times, and Helton fell into that trap many times in 2015 as well. So that's the thing that USC is going to have to, you know, and this is all assuming that USC even has a lead at that point. What if we get into a situation where USC trails going into the fourth quarter? That's something that USC hasn't had to face, like you said, since Stanford. And even then, USC was too far down to Stanford to even call that fourth quarter a real fourth quarter, like win the game comeback attempt. It was just going to be something, you know, something, try to pull off something miraculous. But we don't know what USC's character is in those kinds of crunch moments late in games. We know what Penn State's is, though. And so I think the worst thing USC could do would be to get over cocky and overconfident and act like they've won the game before they've won it.
Yeah, and you know, you talk to Penn State, and Penn State's thing is they don't only just want to lead, they want to be able to finally put together full four quarters. That I don't think they like coming back in the second half. I mean, obviously it's a luxury to be able to do that compared to other things, but you don't want to have to rely on that. You don't want to have to rely on having to do that week in and week out, especially when you're going up against a team like USC, who, if you talk to Koa Farmer from Penn State linebacker Koa Farmer, he says this is the most explosive team that Penn State has ever faced. Garrett Sickles, we talked about it in our little car cast after Disney. This is the most talented team that USC has ever faced. They've played Michigan. They've played Ohio State. They've played these tough games. They got blown out by Michigan. They beat Ohio State in a kind of fluky big play game that went Penn State's way. But this is a different beast in the sense that you don't want to keep doing that. You don't want to keep having to rely on a second half comeback. So if you're Penn State, you definitely want to shut down SC moving on pretty early. You know, what are three things, Alicia, you are looking forward to most in this game? Talking about USC's offense, Penn State's offense, Penn State's defense, USC's defense, whatever it is. What are three things you're looking forward to the most?
I'm definitely looking forward to Justin Davis being back and healthy and seeing the running backs get going and seeing how that all shakes out. I, as with every week, I find that I am very, very curious / looking forward to seeing what Sam Darnold is going to pull out of his hat this week. He is just such a fun player to watch. I'm looking forward to seeing what he does on such a big stage. I think he passed the test on a big stage in Seattle against Washington, and this is the next big test for him to show that he really is this elite level quarterback. I'm excited to see if he can answer that call. And then I am excited. Excited might not be the word, but I'm curious to see how USC secondary deals with the Penn State long ball, big play attempts and the like. I think that is my most intriguing matchup for sure, because I think that's the kind of thing that so much of it comes down to luck. Like, it's not something that I can necessarily predict that USC will or won't be able to handle. You just sort of have to see where the wind blows in those kinds of matchups.
Yeah, and given how important they are to Penn State, those big plays, they're definitely something that you need to be worrisome about if you're USC. The three things I'm looking forward to are pretty straightforward. Definitely all the pageantry, all the funness of a Rose Bowl in general. Number two, I really want to see what happens when you have a really good first half team against a really good second half team, because I think if you're USC, you need to be nervous. And not nervous in a bad way, but nervous in a good way. Nervous in a, we need to be prepared for this.
Conscious way. Of your own mortality.
Yes, you need to be conscious of your own mortality. I think that's a perfect way to say it. Because if you get up, if you have a 31-6 lead or something like that, a big lead that USC has been accustomed to this season in so many different games, if you're feeling that way, if you're feeling like you're comfortable in everything, take a deep breath and just remember, Penn State came down from 28-7 to Wisconsin. Penn State, you know, came back from Indiana in the fourth quarter. They outscored Michigan State 35-0 in the second half. These are things that they just continuously do. So how will USC be able to handle that? Will it be a lot of pressure on them knowing that they need to score early and then hold them off late? Is it debilitating for Penn State knowing that this is a team that is so good in the first half, they have pressure to keep up early? Does that change their game plan? Because you would think one of these teams is going to crack. One of these teams is going to have to play a game that they're not accustomed to. And will that make them stronger or will that hurt them, I think, is going to be the big telling factor. And the other thing that comes down to it for me, the thing I really want to see, who benefits from the big plays? And not necessarily big plays downfield. You look at the Penn State-Ohio State game, blocked kicks. You look at the USC-Washington State game, blocked kicks. You look at the USC-Notre Dame game, return punts, return field goals, return kickoff returns. Those kind of things change games. Those kind of things make the difference when teams are so good on paper. And USC and Penn State are really close on paper when you put everything into account. You can say SC has a better defense and a better offense. Maybe if you compartmentalize it, okay, maybe I'll give you that. But you put everything together and what everything means, these two teams are virtually pretty dead heat. Pretty much a dead heat even matchup. I mean, one team has 9 straight wins, one team has 8 straight wins, one offense looks just like the other offense. They have 2 first-year quarterbacks that are very similar, slippery guys who you could sit back and say they remind you of Johnny Manziel, and running backs who can, you know, be game breakers and wide receivers who can, you know, beat you over the top. They have everything you want to see. And I think that's what makes this matchup the best matchup throughout the bowl season. And I'm so excited to see it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely. I'm biased, so take that for what it is. But I wonder if I was an unbiased person, taking the stakes out of it. When you're looking at the bowl matchups this season, would you rather watch Washington Bama or USC Penn State? I would rather watch the Rose Bowl. Would you rather watch? I mean, I'm intrigued by Clemson Ohio State, but I feel like if you take the stakes out of that game, I still would rather watch USC and Penn State. So this matchup is so intriguing and so interesting, and there's so many different layers to it. It should be fun.
Yeah, I'm super looking forward to it. I can't wait for it. So, Alicia, it is time. It is time. We have waited. We have talked about it. You have, you know, thrown stuff together for it. Give me your score prediction and one key that leads to it.
All right. My weird number score prediction is 39-29. I'm going with a 10-point spread because I'm feeling bold. I'm feeling very bold, and it's going to kick me in the butt
later.
How
do you get to 29?
I have no idea. That's why I picked it.
All right. Fair enough.
You know, there's going to be some crazy play, some returned extra point or something ridiculous. But 39-29, I'm going with. And I think the key to the game, obviously, because I'm picking USC to win, I think the key will be the consistency. And I say that not so much in the idea that USC is a consistent team. I just think that USC is more capable of putting together more scoring drives. Penn State, it always feels like watching them that they need the ball to bounce their way a couple times to get out of the holes that they inevitably dig for themselves. And I think USC is too talented a team, and they're on too good of a run to fall victim to those sort of twists of fate. It's one thing.
Wait, are you saying that Penn State is a high PDO team?
High PDO team?
Yeah, and that they're at some point they're gonna, you know, have a recession.
Are you speaking English right now? I feel like I'm totally missing a reference.
If you get the reference, tweet us at Reign of Troy and tweet at Penguin of Troy and tell her you got the reference. But I mean, I get what you're saying. I definitely get what you're saying. I mean, SC is consistent. Okay, here's an analogy. SC is is consistent and efficient. Efficient is probably the better word there. They're efficient on offense and defense to the point where you can expect, you know what they're going to do, that they're going to just be methodical on offense and defense. That's what they do. They will have big plays, but they're not relying on the big plays. So you can take away the big plays and they're still efficient.
They have consistent big play. That's the thing, is that they're consistent in their big plays going both ways. Like, USC is consistent in the fact that they always give up a big play too on defense, but they're consistent in the fact that that big play doesn't kill them.
Yeah, unless it's Alabama or Stanford.
Unless it's Alabama or Stanford.
Right. Yeah. And I completely agree with you, and I'm going to, you know, a little bit kind of split the difference on your score. 34-28 is my score. My
prediction. That is not a weird enough score.
It's not. But
there's so much even number going on there.
I know, but 34-28 is the score, and really for the same reasons you talk about. I think Penn State will score points. I think that they will definitely score points. I think they will make a big play or two, and maybe turn the game on its head, maybe 2, 3, 4 times. But I think SC will more consistently, move the ball down the field and have 6 scoring drives to 4 scoring drives. Penn State will get touchdowns in all theirs. SC might have to settle for field goals, but they will have more trips down the field.
Okay, so your score is 34-28, right?
Yeah.
Who gets to their final score first? Does USC get to the 34 before Penn State gets to the 28, or does Penn State get to 28 before USC gets to 34?
You always ask something like this, a very similar. I don't know. I'm inclined to say SC does, just the way that SC is a first half team and Penn State's a second half team. But I wouldn't be surprised if this game was like decided by a field goal until the very end and SC tacks on an extra field goal.
Honestly, I will be surprised if this is a game that USC wins. I will be surprised if they have to come back to win it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Like, I think
Not that I don't think they're not capable of it. No, have a game play out like that.
Yeah.
We haven't seen Penn State lose a game at the end like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they lost the Pitt game, but that was a game that they were always chasing anyways. They weren't the chaseees in that sense. I look forward to seeing if SC can score 39 points to Penn State's 29.
I'm more interested. The interesting bit of that is, how on earth is Penn State going to score 29?
I really don't know. They're going to have to figure that out. But it is time to play one of our favorite games going into games in our preview episodes. So let's get to it.
Okay, USC fans, it is time for Over or Under.
Thanks for that, Eddie. Alicia, let's do it. Very last time all season of Over or Under. We each pick two over or unders, and you set the line for me. I pick it. You give a pick in there too, and then vice versa. What is your first over or under in this game?
Over or under, let's go 2.5. Penn State long touchdowns of any sort. So running, receiving, special teams, anything. 2.5.
What constitutes a long touchdown? 40 yards, 30 yards?
Let's go 25 plus. Okay. So touchdowns that come from outside the red zone.
Huh. I feel like two is the right answer, so that makes me want to take the under. Going over and saying that it would be three or four, a lot. I'll take the under. I think Penn State scores two of 25 yards or more. And mind you, I don't think 25 yards or more necessarily means long plays to me. When I think of long plays, I'm thinking of like more than 40. So I am more inclined to take the over than I would normally, but I'll still take the under here.
I am taking the under because I think USC is going to win. But if Penn State wins, I guarantee you it'll be over.
I would buy that. I would definitely buy that. My first over or under is over or under 1.5 number of times Penn State sacks Sam Darnold.
1.5. I'm going to go over on that, actually. I'm going to go over on that because I think Darnold is able to negate a lot of pressure, but Penn State brings so much pressure. I think they could get him two times. I don't think two times would be that many that USC will have given up.
I'm inclined to agree. When you look at the tackles for loss, Penn State ranks third in the country. Garrett Sickles, 12.5 sacks. I'm inclined to agree there. I will say over, though it won't be like 8 or 9 or anything like that. It won't be like John Navarre level status of sacks in a game. What's your second over under?
Okay, so my last over under, because it's me, has to do with tight ends, and that is going to be tight end catches across the board. So the combined tight end totals between USC and Penn State for catches in the game. I'm going to set the over under at 8.5.
8.5. Call me crazy. I'm going over.
You're going over.
I'm going over.
Well, I mean, Jasicki averages something like 4 a game. And I think, I mean, I don't have the exact number, but I would wager that Daniel Amadebebe, Tyler Petit, and Taylor McNamara average somewhere in the area of 4 between the three of them, 4 or 5 a game. I'm still going. I'm going against hype. I'm going with the under here. I don't think I'm going to get that many tight ends.
Really?
Really?
You yeah. Of all people are going under?
I'm going under. This is not what I hope. This is what I think will happen. I'm going under.
All right. All right. All right. Okay. My very last over or under. Over or under number of times cumulative USC fans and Penn State fans start a "We Are" chant.
Cumulative across both fan bases.
Cumulative across both fan bases.
Okay, what are you setting
and
at?
I'm going to set this at, and mind you, there's no way for us to track this. But just rolling with it. Over or under, let's say, and I mean like big, big chance.
En masse, not like individuals standing up and
Yeah, you don't want like Joe Schmo, "We are," and then no one yells, and that doesn't count. Okay, I am going to say cumulative 6.
6.
6.
USC is only going to do it at the end of the game if they're winning. And then post-game and such. Penn State, I would suspect they would do it early in the game. But I don't know if they're yell leaders or if that's something that they do.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Six. I'm going to, en masse, I think I'm going to take the under. But that's because I'm not familiar about whether or not it's like a regular cheer that the Penn State.
I don't know. I don't know how often Penn State uses it. So maybe we're totally talking out of our ass here, which is probably the case. But I am going to say, I'll take the over just slightly because I think that SC will be, if there's a moment of truth in the game, I think SC might do it then in the final moments and then after the game, 3 times. Penn State, I think, will do very similar type of thing, but I think they do it before the game too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think where your 6 number might be correct is that the winning team will do it no less than 3 times.
Right.
Over the course of
the moment of truth, the final moments, and then after the
game. Yes. But Penn State is probably good to do it a couple times in right. the lead up
earlier. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I think yeah. so, because it's Penn State. I mean, Penn State, Notre Dame, SC, they all do the chant. I think Penn State is the one that's a little more eager about it than everybody else. But Alicia, it is time to get into our mailbag. Really small little mailbag today. A couple of emails that we didn't get to, an email and a phone call that we didn't get to before. So let's get to those without our soundboard. So let's just